contribution. Yeah.
Being 8 o'clock, and we have a quorum. Call the meeting. The meeting of the State Government Finance Committee to order.
Because you have to.
Representative Lippert, have you read the minutes?
I have. I move to approve the minutes.
This motion has been made to approve the minutes of January 22nd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are passed. We have before us today, we'll start out with the State Arts Board. We have, so welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I very much appreciate the opportunity today to give you a brief overview of our agency, to introduce you to what the Minnesota State Arts Board is and what we do. For some of you, I think it will be a refresher. For those of you who are new members, I hope that you will find it interesting, and I'll be happy to answer questions of any of the members throughout the presentation or at the end. We are one of the many boards that exists within the executive branch of the state government. We have existed in many forms since the Minnesota legislature created our agency in 1903, and that's not a typo, 1903. We were the second state in the nation, to create a bureau within the state government to focus on matters related to the arts. And if you're a trivia person who would like to know which state created a state agency before we did, find me afterwards. I'm happy to tell you about that. But we've had a long history of the state of Minnesota investing in the arts. On the slide, you'll find our mission, which is to stimulate and encourage the creation, the performance, and the appreciation of the arts throughout the state of Minnesota. It's a broad mission. In many ways, we, like you, need to prioritize. We need to think about how best to use our time and our resources to accomplish this very broad mission on behalf of the state. Pardon me. A little bit of a winter cold today. Our statute is a brief five sections. It's Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 129, DO1 through DO5. Again, very broad. And quite brief. In that section of the statutes, it outlines several key responsibilities, and I put the three most important on the screen, and they're the three that really consume most of our time and our energy. First and foremost, we are charged with being a grant maker, providing financial assistance to stimulate the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state. More than 90% of all the resources you provide to the Arts Board go out the door in the form of a grant. And much of what we do is to manage those grants. And I'll talk a little bit more about that a bit later. It's also our responsibility to be a resource and to provide advice to other state agencies. So you had Mr. Mandel here yesterday from the CAP board. We appoint a person to their architectural advisory committee. We have a permanent seat on the Governor's Residence Council. We have a seat on the newly formed Capital Art Advisory Committee. And just last week, we sent forward a nomination for a person to serve on the State Designer Selection Board. So those are just a few of the places where we are providing service or resources to other state agencies. And then finally, one of our key responsibilities is to serve as the fiscal agent for a series of regional arts councils that exist throughout the state. And again, I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. We also have the responsibility or the ability to make rules. And I know some of you have been interested in the rulemaking process. We don't do it often, but the grant programs that we offer, eligibility, review criteria, those sorts of things are established in Minnesota Rules, Chapter 1900, and our relationship with the Regional Arts Councils is also written into rules as well. So you see one person here today, but really I am one person representing hundreds of people who represent the structure of the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council system. Our board is 11 members appointed by the governor. We have one vacant seat at the moment, so we have 10 members at the moment, 5 members from Greater Minnesota, 5 members from the metro area. And it's their job to come together. They are volunteers. And it's their job to come together and make decisions about how to allocate resources and how to best serve the state. I've given you the link to our board list, so if you're curious about their backgrounds and the expertise that they bring, they're an impressive group. The one thing that statute says is that they all must have some sort of a background or some area of expertise related to the arts, but they are not there to advocate on behalf of any particular artist or art form or arts organization. We have strict conflict of interest rules. They hire me, the executive director. I serve at the pleasure of the board, and then I hire our staff, which right now is 21 FTEs. The real beauty of our work is that we are citizen-driven. So I talked about being a grant maker. I and my staff don't decide who will get the grants. We recruit volunteers from across the state. In any given year, we use about 250 volunteers. To review all of the applications, they come together in open public meetings to discuss those applications, the strengths and weaknesses of the applications, and then they rank them. And the ranked list goes to our board for approval. It's an impressive effort. In our most recent fiscal cycle, those volunteers together contributed more than 12,000 hours of effort. Reading the applications, coming together in the meetings, looking at work samples, in some cases doing site visits. We're really proud of being citizen-driven. We think it's really important. And for applicants, having a public meeting, a chance to come in and hear their proposal being discussed, lets them know what was strong or weak about the proposal. And if they can't be there, if they're far away and they can't be in St. Paul the day we're reviewing the application, we record those conversations and they can get a copy of the recording. So I'll turn now to the duty that I mentioned about being the fiscal agent for the regional arts councils. Pardon me. State statute does not dictate how many regional arts councils there are or what the boundaries are. For those of you who know the Regional Development Commission boundaries, this map will look familiar to you. The regional arts councils were created in the late 1970s, and when they started, they were all programs based in a regional development commission. The funding went to the Regional Development Commission. Over the 40 years that this system has existed, they all have graduated. They're all separate nonprofit organizations. They have local boards made up of members from each of the counties that are in the region. And those boards have local control. So we make a block grant to each regional arts council, and they decide what is needed in that particular region. So they're offering different kinds of programs, different kinds of services based on what's most important in the area. They too recruit volunteers, so that's another 200 to 300 individuals who are involved in decision making about how to spend state dollars. Regional arts councils are not satellite offices of the arts board. They are not state employees. They are locally controlled. And the regional arts council purpose is to stimulate local arts development. So if it's an artist that is wanting to start their career, if it's a volunteer group that wants to hire their first paid administrator, if it's a group that has been doing some activities but really would like to become a year-round entity, how do you do that? How do you grow to be big enough to do that? The councils must submit a two-year plan to us at the beginning of the biennium. We review that plan. They regularly report to us, and quite frankly, we work so closely together that a week does not go by that I don't have some conversation with a regional arts council director on some matter, a question, some topic that we're working on together. So we work very closely together. Very briefly, the other thing that we are responsible for, and it relates back to being an advisor to other state agencies. In the 1980s, the state legislature created what's called the Percent for Art in Public Places program. It's the way that the state has been investing in public art in its state-funded buildings. If you look at the statute, number 16B is not our statute. It's the Department of Administration's statute. But since the program was created, they have delegated that responsibility to us. And so when the capital investment bill is passed, if an entity would like to use some of that money to purchase or commission a work of art, they are able to do so. It's not mandatory. It's permissive. And it's up to 1%. So it really is up to the agency receiving the funds to decide if they want to do that. Over the 35 years the program has existed, hundreds of works have been created for our public buildings throughout the state. And in fact, as we speak, one of those sculptures is being placed at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. All right. I'm so sorry. We believe that the state of Minnesota invests in the arts not because artists need resources or because arts organizations need to fund their activities, but the state invests in the arts because the arts are good for the state. There are many ways that the arts contribute to our individual lives and our collective lives, be that positive youth development activities, academic achievement, contributing to the strength of our communities, health and well-being, economic development, and a variety of other ways. I was really struck the other day when you had the state economist here, and she was talking to you about the state population, how domestic migration is one of the ways that our population is growing and will be an important way for the state to keep growing, and the challenges that we're having finding workers for all of the jobs that are needed. And I'm sorry, I don't remember which of you asked, but one of you asked her, well, how do we make sure this is a trend? How do we make sure people keep moving to Minnesota so that we'll have the workers we need? And she said to you, invest in the things that will make people want to live here. Well, we believe that the arts are one of the things that make people want to live here, especially younger people, especially if you're thinking about younger workers and younger families who really are choosing where they live based on the life they can have, rather than simply the job that they might have. And so we see ourselves as a tool in the work that the state is doing. And in fact, a full 90% of Minnesotans, when asked by a survey at the University of Minnesota, said that they believe that the arts are important to Minnesota's quality of life. So I will go somewhat quickly through some graphs and slides. This is not our budget presentation, but these are meant to help you kind of get a sense of who our organization is and the scope of our resources. So this first slide is our total agency revenue for the current biennium. The blue slice of the pie, the largest slice, comes from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which for us was such a significant change and opportunity for us to be able to do some new and different kinds of things. The very small red slice is resources that we receive from the federal government, from grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. That's about 2% of our annual revenue. And then the green slice is where this committee's jurisdiction lies. These are the general fund dollars. Right now, that's about 20% of our total annual revenue. It's $15 million for the biennium. Focusing in more on that green slice, these are the general fund appropriations that the agency has received. And I gave you a 20-year snapshot just so you could see what the trend line looked like. You'll see that for us, the high water mark in general fund appropriations was in the 2000-2001 cycle. We had some turbulence in the early part of the 2000s, and since 2012, we have leveled at about, thank you, David, we have leveled at about $15 million per year, and we have been flat at that level since then. This is a graph that shows you where those dollars are spent. I had mentioned to you that grants are the significant thing that we do. So the largest, the green slice of the pie, is all of the grants that the Arts Board makes. That's 64% of the expenditures in a year. The blue slice are the grants to the regional arts councils. It's roughly a third of the dollars that are available. And the red slice is everything else that doesn't leave our office in the form of a grant. So it's staff, it's reimbursement for those volunteers that I talked about or for board members, it's rent, it's IT, it's phones, it's materials, supplies, those sorts of things. Of that 8%, 73% of it is staff salaries. We are, like many agencies, we are very driven by the people who are doing the work. When you administer grants, it's about the work of reviewing those grants, providing resources and technical assistance to the applicants, and then following up with the reporting and the monitoring. I wanted to talk a little bit about what what those grants are and what they do, just to give you a sense. This is a lot of numbers, and there are tens of thousands of stories about what happens with those dollars. For the Arts Board, we are investing general fund dollars in two key ways. One is investing in what we call the backbone of the Minnesota arts community. It's about 180 organizations across the state of Minnesota, and we're making small investments in their mission-driven activities and in their ability to provide education and outreach. So you know them. Some of them are the largest organizations in the state, like the Minneapolis Institute of Art, now calling itself MIA, the Guthrie Theater. But it's also smaller organizations, like the Fairmont Opera House or the Grand Marais Arts Colony, the Central Lakes Performing Arts Center in Brainerd, or the Itasca Orchestra in Grand Rapids. And it's also all of those mid-sized arts organizations that really are really so essential to the vibrancy of our arts community. It's Penumbra, it's the Cedar Cultural Center, it's the Barn Theater in Wilmer, it's Lanesboro Arts, it's 180 organizations. One of the things those organizations are required to do is to provide education and outreach activities. They might be a theater or a musical organization, but they must do education and outreach. In the most recent fiscal year, 2018, together they provided more than 11,000 education and outreach activities. So they really are committed to providing service to the state. We also invest some of those grants in the professional development of artists, either things that will allow them to advance their abilities as an artist, try new things, or to invest in their career as artists. And I have a number of examples. I'll just give you two of them. We made a grant to an artist from the Duluth area who wrote a manuscript about his father's experience in the Vietnam War. And then they do their project and they give back to the community. In his case, what he did was to give readings from his manuscript in community in areas, communities in his area. Another of the examples is that a Minneapolis artist, a young woman named Ephraim Mansour, whose family escaped Somalia when she was a child. You all know about the war in Somalia. And she wrote a play called How to Have Fun in a Civil War. And it was really telling her story about what it was like to be a little girl trying to flee with her family from a war-torn country. And it's become actually quite popular. It has been performed in a number of venues around the state. The regional arts councils are using their general fund dollars to fund projects. Again, remember thinking that it's about local arts development. So a project grant might be, and I picked some examples as well, funding the Vintage Band Festival, which happens once a year in Northfield, or providing funding to the Community Arts Education Program in Norwood Young America for their summer music series. They also spend their general fund dollars on consulting, training, professional development activities. So if an organization wants to hire someone to help them develop a strategic plan or a board development plan, or if an organization is interested in learning how to do fundraising and wants to go to a workshop or something like that, many of the regional arts councils can provide those resources. The Five Wings Arts Council, which is based in Staples, has a program that if you are a volunteer driven organization and you would like to become a 501c3, they can help you do that. They can help you walk through that process. And so that's one of the programs they're doing. And many of the regional arts councils are also investing in some programs for schools, related to schools. That might be a school residency, bringing in an artist to come in and supplement what's available. And in the Northwest Minnesota region, East Grand Forks, Red Lake Falls, Winnemac, that regional arts council provides grants to schools so that they can buy some supplies or equipment. It might be a drum set, it might be risers for the high school choir, it might be some of those things that can be used not just by the school, but then it is available to the community. We think the beauty of the way that we work is that we don't pick three or four different kinds of things and put a lot of money into them. We try to fund things all across the state so that there might be something for everyone, or there might be ways that everyone could find something that would be of value to them. I'll go very quickly through the last two slides because it's more numbers. Here is a snapshot just to give you a sense of scope. We've given you the last two biennia and the first year of this year. Obviously, we're not finished with the second year yet. But as a system, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils review about 7,600 applications per year. We make and manage about 4,500 grants. And if you look at the dollars requested, you can see that we are not meeting the demand. There are so many ideas, so many worthwhile projects that we wish we could fund, but we don't have the resources. So like you, we make choices about which of those programs seem to be the strongest and the potentially the most successful. And then Mr. Geldman and I were having a chat about, can we break this out and show you state government versus all? So the yellow or the orange bars on the left show you all the total number of grants that we've made or the total dollars awarded. And then the shorter bars on the right-hand side are the ones that are being funded with general fund dollars. So I remember I mentioned that it's about 20% of our annual revenue. And I'll give you one last slide, and then I will stop. This is the slide that we are most proud of. It's the one that we think is most important. In a biennium, the projects and activities that the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council's funds serves a combined audience of nearly 25 million people. And a significant number of those are young people. And so as you think about your budget, as you think about the overall state budget, a $42 billion, $43 billion state budget, $15 million might not seem like a lot, but we think it's a lot. And we think that it's a vital investment in lots of different ways that Minnesotans are connecting with one another, ways that people are either developing their own creativity or encouraging the creativity of others. It also is an economic driver in Minnesota. The arts industry is about a $2 billion industry. And we think that the arts are one of the things that help make Minnesota an exceptional place to live and work, which I know is something that we all share as a goal. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop. I will take a sip of water, and I will answer your questions.
Well, thank you for that. And Representative, our legislative auditor, Nobles, was here yesterday, and he claimed that he was here in the legislature working when the auditor's office was created. You're much too young to have been here when the Arts Board was created.
That's true. In fact, that's the year that my father was born. So he also would not have been here in 1903. But we are the second state in the country to have created an agency within state government to be concerned with matters related to the arts.
And I got a list of questions here. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jens, thank you for the work that you and your staff do and all of your volunteers. You mentioned the quality of life impact of the arts and the need to be attractive as a state for competitiveness for workers. And in your closing remarks, you also mentioned the $2 billion of economic impact that the arts have. Does the board track the economic impact of arts in Minnesota over time, or do you have data on how that's changed or what impact the arts are having on the overall economy of the state?
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long. The Arts Board does not track that. There is a separate entity called Creative Minnesota that has been creating economic impact reports for the last maybe 10 years. They will do a new report usually every 2 years. The Arts Board is a member of that coalition of organizations, so a member of our staff is on that, and we have provided some resources to help with the research. But the Creative Minnesota report is available online, and I think I'm not giving any secrets away if I say that there will be a new report released very soon, probably on Arts Advocacy Day, which will be coming up in March. And the economic impact has been growing as there are more activities. And the economic impact, I'm not the expert because I don't manage that project, but it's measuring both spending by artists and arts organizations, and it's spending by audiences. So it takes a total view of the impact of the arts. And much of the research is actually done in Washington by an organization called Americans for the Arts, where we send them, the Minnesota data is sent to them. They're the ones who do the analysis of it and then send back the numbers.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that last question, what is staff probably knows, what is the percent of a project that's required to be spent on art? I remember there being when we had projects, there was a certain percentage of a large project that is devoted to art.
I think Ms. Jens has the answer to that question, because I don't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, I think you are referring to the Art in Public Buildings, the Percent for Art program that I mentioned very briefly. The statute says that up to 1% of an appropriation over $500,000 may be spent to purchase and commission art. So an entity may choose to spend nothing on art, or an entity may choose to spend the full 1% of whatever they are appropriated through the capital investment bill. But it is entirely up to the agency that is doing it, whether they want to spend those dollars or not.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. On slide 14, are you referring to all of your grants and activities? You just had it up.
This one?
No, on our, what we have number where there's a number 14 in with the biennial participation. Is that for all the programs or just the general fund programs?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, that's all of our activities together. It's not just the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
So, and your other things, you only show all in your slide 8, which, you know, your revenue sources, and the vast majority of that is legacy. So what portion of the slide 14 is from general fund and from legacy?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I'm going to move back to this slide just for a second. We did break out here the number of grants and the dollars awarded from general fund versus all funds. We have not broken out audiences based on revenue source, in part because it might be somewhat difficult to do that, and I'll give you an example. I talked about investing in arts organizations through one of our grant programs. We were providing those kinds of resources before the legacy amendment passed. And then when the legacy amendment passed, and as I think many of you know, the language in the legacy amendment says you must supplement, not substitute for. So we continued to put general fund dollars into that grant program, and then we added legacy dollars to the program as well. So would you count the audience member as a general funded audience member, or would you count them as a legacy funded audience member? It gets a little bit difficult to separate that out, but if we were to just take percentages, we might be able to separate out those numbers for you.
Mr. Chair, actually, when I've analyzed through the years the grants given out, it is able to determine what grants were general fund grants and what grants were legacy grants, and it's also, you have to do the work, but you can also see that you know, in some years, 80-85% of the legacy grants go to a few large entities within the state, mostly in a portion of the metro. And so I was trying to understand if, you know, it's pretty easy because you know what dollars, grant dollars come from one source or the other. So if you're tracking the total audience, you also have the data because it's correlated to events and streams to be able to understand the effectiveness of, you know, the grant distribution has, and then also be able to understand what the impact of the regional versus the more statewide large entities like the Guthrie and other well-established organizations. So, you know, basically my interest is I'd like to understand how we're allowing the growth of a diverse art culture that isn't necessarily defined by a few entities, but is defined by the individual cultures and communities within portions of the state, so that that helps those communities to have that culture out and vibrant, instead of conforming to a centralized centrist. And that's why I was trying to understand between the general and the legacy, and you've sort of blended, and some of the stuff you show both, and I don't see any pie or any other stuff on the legacy, so that's why I was trying to have a better, more transparent view of what your organization actually does and when you're presenting reports.
I just didn't hear much of a question there, but Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director Jens. You know, you said that there's a lot of volunteers, that you use volunteers. Who picks the volunteers?
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, on our staff, we have a person who recruits volunteers. We put out an open call for anybody who would like to serve as a volunteer, and we're always eager to have volunteers. But we have a person whose job it is to be contacting people throughout the state of Minnesota asking if they would be willing to be volunteers. At the regional arts councils, I think only the metropolitan organization do they have a staff person who is spending part of their time doing that. In other cases, they're doing an open call asking for people to come in and volunteer. The volunteers in all cases need to have some sort of expertise in the arts. They don't necessarily have to be working in the arts. And in fact, one of the things that we're doing is trying to move more away from people who are working in the arts to people who have an interest in the arts but might be working in other fields, so that we get a broader perspective of people to come in. In our case, all of those names are forwarded to the board, and then the board has to approve them to serve as volunteer advisors.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because that, you know, there's a lot of money that goes out, and it's nice to know that there's somebody kind of monitoring the volunteers. Because, and then also you said that the Arts Council does review the people who are picked for the grants and to make sure they're right. And I've, you know, there's pages and pages of this stuff. And, you know, we've got grants to individuals here too, not just entities. And, you know, I've got the list in my office here. I've just got it broken down on, I haven't broken it down, it's just on computer, but, you know, $10,000 for a 3D printer, for instance. Grants from $500 up to $5,000 and higher for laptops, cameras, inkjet printers. So really, it seems like some of this stuff isn't, we're just buying people new computers or, you know, or equipment. And so that, you know, that's a little disturbing. Can you tell me explain to us what a partnership grant is?
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Green, for that question. If you don't mind, I'd like to respond first to the one about the equipment, and then I certainly will tell you about the partnership grants. Decades, hundreds of years ago, artists used quill pens and paintbrushes to do their work. Now artists are using computers to do their work. So if you are a composer, you are likely composing on a computer. You're using a software program that helps you annotate the music that you're composing. If you're a dancer, you are probably, rather than physically writing down the stroke marks to write down a piece of choreography, you're doing it on a computer. So the tools of an artist now are technology, like the rest of us. And so whether it's a printer or a camera for someone who is a photographer, that is a tool that they use to help either advance their career. It might be a different kind of camera than they have used before, and it allows them to take different kinds of photographs, or it allows them to develop those photographs in a different way. So it is part of the work that artists do now. For those of us who are Luddites, I kind of wish the old days would come back and everything were done without computers. But it is the way that artists do their work, and so that it is an allowable cost if it's necessary for the project. To your second question about partnership grants, the Arts Board sets aside about $100,000 of its legacy funds every year, and those we use for special projects that will sort of like the regional arts councils, things that will develop the capacity of the field that might help make the arts community a stronger community. And so we will pick special projects that we want to use those partnership grants. Again, they're legacy funds, but I'm happy to tell you about them. We just approved one of those partnership grants at our January board meeting, and we're going to bring a person from Washington, D.C. to Minnesota who is an expert on accessibility for festivals. If you've ever been to an outdoor festival, you know that it can be kind of challenging for a person in a wheelchair or maybe a person who has sight limitations. And so that person is going to come to Minnesota. The grant is actually going to an organization, and I'm going to blank on the name, so don't quote me on this, but I'll get it pretty close. I think it's called the Minnesota Festival and Event Association. It's a nonprofit organization. We made the grant to them. They are going to bring this woman who is an expert. She's worked with the Smithsonian and other large institutions on how do you make a festival more accessible to people with a disability. So we do those kinds of things with those partnership dollars that come out of the Legacy Fund to try to improve the experience that arts organizations and artists can provide for all Minnesotans. And you'll see a few of those every year in our grants list. Did I answer your question?
Kind of, yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, can you tell me what the Forum of Regional Arts Councils is?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Green, that is an organization. It's actually a 501c3. It's the executive directors of the 11 regional arts councils. And they come together and they meet once a month. And it's really a way for them to support and help one another develop their work. They do best practices sessions to talk about, well, we've had this problem. What are you doing about this problem? They came together and they did research about grants management systems, and they actually have all picked now to use the same grants management systems. So it's the 11 executive directors of the regional arts councils who meet together on a regular basis to try to support and connect one another to resources. If you think about the state, there are only 11 people who are doing that kind of job, so it's a way for them to really try to it's professional development for themselves as well.
Mr. Chair, so the Forum of Regional Arts Councils made up of council members from the Arts Council, I guess, but how much money do they grant themselves to do projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, they are using this year $10,000 that they use primarily for travel reimbursement. So when the forum often will meet in Alexandria or in, blanky for a moment, St. Cloud. So when the executive director, who is based in Warren, Minnesota, is driving to that meeting, she can request travel reimbursement from the forum to cover her costs to travel to that meeting. Or the director, whose office is based in Marshall, could request funding to help with travel reimbursement. It generally relates to the ability of people to go to those meetings and to participate in those meetings, and then they aren't taking it out of their own regional resources. But this is an agreement that the 11 of them have made together to put some of that money aside to help with forum expenses.
Okay. Mr. Chair, well, in the past they have...
One last question, because we have a list here.
Okay. In the past they have gotten quite a bit more. I mean, there's been grants where they've given themselves $50,000 to support grantees. And I will end here, too, but there's a lot of other questions, and maybe we'll get to them in some of the other committees as well. But, you know, some of the money from Legacy, for instance, that goes out of state. And, I did mention in Legacy the other day that one person got a $10,000 grant to go to the Caribbean to view the sunsets to get ideas for paintings. And that was probably one of the most egregious granted, but there's a lot of other ones too. And I would like to know just, you know, who, if it's the volunteers picking these, and as the Arts Council okays these, how are they looking into them? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr.
Chair, may I respond? I'll take them in the order. I think that I remember them. You talked about a $50,000 grant that the forum had, and I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. Those would not have been state dollars. The McKnight Foundation also provides a grant to the Forum of Regional Arts Councils. Many of you know that the McKnight Foundation has an arts program, and they have for many years used the Regional Arts Councils as one of the ways that they can fund artists across the state. And so the McKnight Foundation also makes a grant to the Forum of Regional Arts Councils. And I don't know if it's $50,000 or not, but I can assure you that the Forum of Regional Arts Councils is not using $50,000 of state money for its activities. Right now, it's using $10,000 of state money for its activities. So I'd be happy to talk more about that, because I'd like to understand your concern or your question. And then your question about an artist going to the Caribbean. You had mentioned that the other day. We did a search of our database. We don't find an artist going to the Caribbean, so I'd love to talk to you more about that. And if you know more about that, Grant could tell me more about it. I will say that during the 2013 session, and as I look around the table, many of you were here, right before the end of the session, there was a conversation about artists going out of the state for projects. And that's something that we were able to do for many, many years. We were using state general fund dollars, and we were using federal dollars for artists to leave the state to do research. If they had written a symphony and it was going to be premiered somewhere, they would have the chance to go and conduct or work with the orchestra. They often would go and maybe make paintings or take photographs, and then they would come back to Minnesota and they would share that work. Those were general fund dollars, and those were federal dollars. They were not legacy dollars, because the legacy requirement has always been that funds must be spent on projects in the state. The 2013 legislative session, the legislature put a restriction also on general fund dollars, so that those dollars now must be spent only on projects in the state. And so since the fiscal 14 cycle, all of the dollars have been spent on projects in the state of Minnesota. So a full 6 grant cycles now. All projects must be taking place within the state of Minnesota. So I don't know if the grant that you're referring to happened before 2014, when it was allowed to use general fund dollars and federal dollars. In fact, we still could be using federal dollars for artists to go outside of the state. We're not. We are using them the same way we're using the state dollars.
Representative Elkins.
And if we could make them short and
most of my question's been answered, but clearly the most of what's presented here is the general fund appropriation, because that's what we fund. But it sounds like you get money from a lot of different sources, including the legacy amendment and foundation money as well. And I imagine if I looked on your website somewhere, I would find the distribution of all of the sources.
Ms. Jensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, you would find on our website a list of all of the grants we made. Mm-hmm. We don't list them necessarily by source. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a list that says these are the grants we funded.
No.
By the
but
National
you have a list of all your sources, though, I would guess?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And to be clear, there are only 3 sources now.
Okay.
It is the State General Fund, it's the Legacy Fund, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We don't receive funding from foundations. The regional arts councils can and do, but we don't.
I understand. Thank you.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jens, this is just a quick comment and a thank you. So I represent the Northfield area, and you mentioned the Vintage Band Festival. I just want to thank the Arts Board for that and provide some context for this festival, too. So this is a quirky festival that it was the vision of someone in Northfield, and it draws bands from all over the country and all over the world as well, and draws people from throughout the region, and they come to Northfield for a weekend every summer. And the town is crawling with people, and it gets people out of their houses and benefiting the economy. And there's a group of dedicated volunteers that meets regularly to plan this. I know this because they meet in the congregation that I serve. I just want to thank the Arts Board for making this possible. It's unique to Northfield, and it's good for us and good for the region, too.
Thanks for that. I did hear a question there. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I basically was just going to echo what Representative Lippert said, that I've had the opportunity to sit down with our regional council on numerous occasions and brought artists in to learn about their projects. And I think it's helpful to have you here, but I think one of the best learning opportunities we can do as legislators is actually go into our districts and see how this impacts us. And I know they'd be more than happy to educate. And I learned a wealth of how this is impacting my own community, and coming from, you know, it's really wonderful. So I just hope all legislators take that opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Now, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, I'm just going to refer quickly for a couple of clarifications to your presentation. On the slide where it talks about the number of grants and the dollars awarded, I'm just wondering, actually, I'm sorry, it's on slide 9. which talks about general fund appropriations, and there's not going to be a question, just a request on this one, but I'm just wondering if you could overlay the legacy funds on an annual basis back there. If you could just put an overlay on that bar chart for the legacy funds as well, mm-hmm. I think it would be helpful to the committee to see the trend line as it would pertain to the legacy funds for those same time measurements as well. It's not skewed, but I think we're missing a part of the overall equation in terms of your funding itself. Then to, and this is just a clarification for myself, you know, the population of Minnesota is about 5.7 million, but yet on slide, bear with me, 14, you mentioned 24.6 million participants, and I'm inferring there that that's touches with multiple students or multiple adults. I would ask if there's any delineation between the adults in terms of demographics, whether that is the, pardon the expression, the younger crowd or the older crowd. And I'm wondering if, and this is a request as well, no answer necessary right now, but if there's a delineation in terms of what demographic are participating in these programs. Now to my question. Oftentimes communities, particularly in the arts area, whether it be in any number of arts, there is a synergy that culminates in someone finding expression or finding a new idea about a music piece or an art piece or a means of expression. And usually that culminates when they're around each other. And when people are congregating around one each other, there's economic development that is beneficial to the community, such as Northfield, such as Hastings, and other areas. So I'm wondering to what extent, whether it be just for the sense of synergy between the artists themselves or truly economic development, do you involve yourself or consider the idea of affordable housing for the arts, the artists, as they would want to be around one another and have the availability to share ideas, to feed off each other, and to benefit the communities that they live in and around, and as they congregate, develop other ideas, they spawn and create other economic opportunities. So I'm just wondering if you thought about that, if you have a short response or something that we could follow up with the Arts Board on at a later date.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that very good question, Representative Albright. I had mentioned early on that the Arts Board really isn't a programmer. You know, we don't have programs for affordable housing, but we fund an organization called ArtSpace. It's in Minneapolis, and I think that name must be sparking an idea for you. We fund ArtSpace. It is one of those organizations that receives general fund dollars and legacy dollars supplemented for its activities. It is a nonprofit real estate development organization that does just that, affordable housing, live workspaces for artists. And you mentioned Hastings. I hope you've been to the location in Hastings that they just opened up. They have opened up other spaces in Minnesota. Many of them are here in the Twin Cities because there is obviously a significant population of artists in the Twin Cities, but there's also one in Fergus Falls. There's one in Brainerd. And in other places. ArtSpace doesn't necessarily go to a community saying, we're here, we want to build affordable housing for your artists. What happens is the community comes to them and says that we see this as a value. We see that having artists who can afford to live and work here and be part of our community is useful, and so ArtSpace will work with them to find the financing, to find the developers, the construction organizations to make that work. Oftentimes they're reclaiming a building. I don't think that's true in Hastings. I think Hastings was a brand new development. But in Brainerd, what they did is they took the old high school that had been decommissioned and they turned it into a live workspace for artists in Brainerd. In Fergus Falls, I think it was an old hotel, the Cadets Hotel, that was turned into live workspace for artists. So yes, we think it's a really important thing. We aren't doing it, but we are funding an organization that can be doing that, not just here in Minnesota, but across the country. They're doing a statewide program in Colorado that's being funded by the Colorado equivalent of the Arts Board.
Representative Vogel. And that's the last question. There's one more, but Representative Vogel, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to test fire, you're doing a lot of grants to a lot of different agencies and so forth. So the question is that I'm curious what the policy is to get a CPA opinion audits from all of those entities, and if you don't get some from who they are. And then secondly, internally, how you go about reviewing them to see if indeed they are doing what they should be doing.
Ms. Jans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, thank you. That's a very good question. The state of Minnesota requires any nonprofit organization with revenues over $750,000 to have a certified audit. So we do as well. If you're an organization that has a budget that size, we ask you to submit your audit as part of your application. If you're an organization whose budget is less than that, we will ask you to submit your 990 so that we at least have some document that you have submitted to another entity, and we look at that. If you're a very small organization and you don't have to file a 990, we will ask you for your board financial statements. And, in fact, we'll ask you for board financial statements even if you have an audit or a 990 so that we can corroborate them. In our operating support program, we're looking at all of those financial statements as well as the budget that they send in. That's part of our review process to make sure that it's an organization that is sound and can manage its finances in a good way. If it's a project budget, we're primarily looking at the project budget that they're submitting. How would they propose to spend the dollars? Does it seem reasonable? Are artists being paid a fair wage as part of the project and those sorts of things? But we do ask for those other financial documents for the organization if they have them. And then when the final report comes in, or again, if it's a project, we're matching up, did they spend the dollars the way they proposed to spend them? And with the operating support, does their annual budget look in line with what their annual budgets look like in the past? So, yes, we do ask for audits when they are required by the state to have audits.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, that's the last question.
This will be a real quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, does the Arts Board, with the funds they hand down, do they give workshops to individuals, such as our state's so diverse throughout the rural areas and metro, do they give workshops to individuals for grant writing or to go down those trails to make these grants more accessible to individuals?
Ms. Jens, quickly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, thank you for that question. Yes, we do. The Arts Board provides training sessions about how to apply for a grant from the Arts Board. We do that throughout the state. We're not out there as often as we would like to be, in part because of resource and time constraints, but we do at least once a year make a swing throughout the state, and we always encourage applicants to call us and talk with us. The regional arts councils also do that, thinking again about local arts development. Many times they're the first touch that someone will have with state funding, and so they might have their first grant writing workshop with their regional arts council before they would start to apply to the Arts Board or come to us. But we're trying to do more of that, especially in diverse communities that might not think about, gee, I'm going to call someone from the government for help. And so how do we deal with communities that aren't thinking about us as a resource so that we can get funding to their projects and activities?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. And
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, you teased us throughout the presentation. So we're just waiting to find out who was the first state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, do you have a guess?
Ms. Jeans, Ms. Jones.
I hope it wasn't Wisconsin.
Dare I say Wisconsin has never beat us in anything, right? It was actually Utah.
Oh.
They created a state arts agency in 1899.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if you think about it, we have had an agency in state government devoted to the arts longer than we have had our current state capitol building.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
And hopefully we can get through the next two presentations a little quicker. We have next is the overview of the Humanities Center. Think about who would want this job, who would actually be qualified for it. And you'd almost have to look for like an experienced CIO who was nearing retirement, already had more money than God, and wanted to do it.
You could come in and hug him here.
I will get out of your way.
And he also goes on here with the mouse. Very
beat this PC.
6 year turnaround.
And yours should be right down there somewhere.
4 years.
There we go. Welcome to the committee, and grab another third chair there. Yep, and please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your presentation.
Great. Hopefully this works. Can you hear me all right? Good morning, Chair Nelson and members of the State Government Finance Division. My name is Meredith Beeson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Humanities Center. I've served on their board for about 5 years, and I'm currently serving as vice chair. Our interim president, unfortunately, couldn't be here today. Her name is Ann Hunter, and she had some previously scheduled site visits, so again, she sends her best regards. But I am excited to have Leandra Burchell here with me, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Hello, Chair Nelson and committee members. My name is Leandra Burchell. I am the Vice President of the Minnesota Humanities Center.
So where we're going to start today is a very quick run-through of our mission, a little bit about our programming, and then end with our financials. So a little bit about the mission of the Minnesota Humanities Center is to build a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. The Minnesota Humanities Center is a nonprofit organization with a state charter that offers programs and events throughout the state. We are the recognized state organization for the National Endowment for the Humanities, and MHC focuses on public humanities by bringing literature, ethics, philosophy, civics, and history out of scholarly institutions and into the lives of Minnesotans. Our building includes a full-service event center, and it's located over on the east side of St. Paul, steps away from Lake Phelan. And the historic building was actually built in 1924 as part of the original Gillette Children's Hospital. Our building is the only remaining structure from the old hospital campus, and it's on the state's register of historic places. The hospital was in operation until the early 1970s, and we actually still have some former patients that stop by and share their stories, which is pretty cool. The Minnesota Humanities Center was founded in 1971 when the National Endowment for the Humanities began providing in-state funding for programs. During these early days, MHC was commissioned to serve exclusively as a grant-making institution. And in 1978, the Minnesota legislature appropriated $50,000 for the Minnesota Humanities Center for general operations. This early investment from the state reflected confidence in and support for the work of MHC. Through the 80s and 90s, MHC work as a grant-making organization shifted into public programming. During the 1990s, MHC brought more books, traveling exhibits, speakers, and events to people across the state. And as the Humanities Center moved away from just a pure grant-making institution, we began to look at the K-12 education system. And this education work really started by surveying what Minnesota teachers needed in terms of continuing education and curriculum development. Our Educators Institute, which started in 2015, has its roots in this early work to support teacher training and development. Today, the Minnesota Humanities Center continues to engage the state's educators and communities by exploring absent narratives, that is, voices often left out or marginalized. Just this summer, Minnesota Humanities Center did a series of listening sessions across the state. You'll hear more from Leandra about this in a little bit. But for the last 47 years, the Minnesota Humanities Center has been focused on educational program and exploring Minnesota's various cultures and histories using the humanities. And now I'll turn it over to Leandra, who will talk a little bit more about our programs and how the Minnesota Humanities Center lives up to our mission of building a more thoughtful, literate, and engaged society.
Thank you, Meredith. The Minnesota Humanities Center creates programs that explore the complexities of the human experience. We engage our state's communities through five core programs. Veterans Voices uses storytelling, workshops, and awards to amplify Minnesotan veterans' experiences. We Are Water examines the practical, spiritual, and environmental roles of water in our lives through traveling exhibits that collaborates with each community to ensure that local stories are included and recorded. K-12 Education continues our education legacy through workshops and field trips that examine the manifold cultures live in Minnesota. Native Nations of Minnesota deepens our understanding of place. Our offerings include interactive websites, workshops, field trips, and the award-winning Why Treaties Matter exhibit, which is on permanent display at the state capitol. And community conversations engage the members of the public who are interested in learning from and with diverse communities and in exploring how the humanities connect us to one another. Our programs are available to all Minnesotans. We engage people all over the state in a variety of ways, including workshops, traveling exhibits, documentaries, and published works, just to name a few. Our participants include community leaders, civic educators, veterans, Native Nations, authors, storytellers, environmentalists, librarians, scholars, students, and legislators. Central to our work is a relationship-based approach that guides what we do and how we do it. For each tangible experience from the Humanities Center, there is an equally important and powerful relationship that is formed. These relationships are centered in our four core values, which are to build and strengthen relationships, learn from and with multiple voices, amplifying community solutions for change, and recognizing the power of story and the power of story and the danger of absence. We ground these values in the philosophy that the community leads and we follow. Last summer, as Meredith mentioned, we held 10 listening sessions in 12 communities across the state. They were attended by community leaders, including mayors, university professors, K-12 educators, business leaders, and some of those participants were familiar with who we are and some were not. Through those gatherings, we were able to identify three ways that we can deepen our engagement across the state by forming more comprehensive partnerships with 2- and 4-year colleges and universities, by establishing a more robust presence in community by developing partnerships with local governments, and by increasing our direct financial contributions to communities via grants. Place also surfaced as a critical touch point for participants. They underline the importance of centers and convening spaces, the cultural significance of specific regions across the state, like the Iron Range or central and northern Minnesota, and the need for engagement with the physical environment. This feedback provides us with not only directions for the next 3 to 5 years for our programs, but it also affirms the importance of our network, our statewide networks of partnerships. We're proud to say since 1971 that we've partnered with thousands of organizations and individuals, including the Minnesota Historical Society, Twin Cities PBS, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Department of Health, the Science Museum of Minnesota, Women's Veterans Initiative, Smithsonian Institution, Friends of the St. Paul Public Library, St. Louis County Historical Society, and Black Ink, Fond du Lac Band of Lake Chippewa, and a wide variety of educational institutions ranging from the University of Minnesota to Carleton College, to Moorhead Public Schools and everything in between. We believe it is our responsibility to engage with communities, to understand their issues and their solutions, which means our programs are continuously changing, developing, and evolving to meet and reflect the needs of Minnesotans. We want to ensure that our work, doesn't inadvertently exclude any voices. And we are planning to expand our Learning from Place program into Greater Minnesota. We're planning to deepen our collaborations with schools by working for year long with each school in different parts of Minnesota in cohorts, so that we can deepen that work as opposed to our current structure of week-long or a day-long professional development opportunities. And we're developing new veterans initiatives with the VA hospitals across the state. In your packets, you'll find a list of our upcoming programs, and we invite you to attend one if your schedule and your interests permit. I'm now going to turn it back over to Mayor to discuss our financials and to provide another overview.
And as Leandra said, there's plenty of information in the packets, both on our mission program, and I'm going to run through our financials very quickly, but you'll see this document. It's on the screen behind me, and it gives a good overview of where our revenue sources are. So MHC has a diverse funding model that includes support from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the state of Minnesota, grants from both corporations and foundations, as well as individual donors. So first up on the column farthest to the left, it is our private support column, and this Minnesota Humanities has significant private support, which includes corporate sponsorships and foundation grants, and that totals about $12.6 million. We also have a strong base of individual donors who do support our work. MHC also works hard to partner with other organizations, as Leandra said, to collaborate on events. That amplifies our impact. An example of this collaborative approach is the We Are Water program, where we partnered with four state agencies and the Historical Society to bring the water exhibit to towns across Minnesota. Revenue from these partnerships is $1.5 million. So next I'll spend a little time talking about the state's investment with the Minnesota Humanities Center. The state's general fund appropriation is currently $750,000 for the biennium. And just a quick mention, every point on the financial document that you're looking at, these are a biennium totals, not annual giving. So again, the state appropriation for the biennium is $750,000. The money is critical to support MHC's program, events, and technology and core functions. We also operate as a pass-through entity for other programs, and this includes Healthy Eating and the Veterans Defense Project. MHC also receives money from the Legacy Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. With these legacy investments, we have provided new and innovative programming, including the Veterans Voices Award Ceremony, our Educators Institute, and Why Treaties Matter exhibit, which Leandra mentioned is over at the Capitol. MHC also manages pass-through grants within the Legacy Fund. I won't get into it, but it's on the backside of your funding overview document. We take our responsibility to be the best stewards of state funds very, very seriously and maintain strong accountability over our programming, and we hold everyone that we grant to equally high standards. Lastly, Minnesota Humanities Center gets support from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We receive about $1.5 million from NEH. The strong support from the state and NEH are really the backbones of our funding. Again, thank you for the opportunity this morning to talk about the Minnesota Humanities Council, and thank you for the support. We're happy to take any questions. I know we cruised through a lot of information very, very quickly, but thank you for the time.
Well, thank you, and there's a lot of information in the package you gave us, so hopefully we can look at that and not have to spend a lot of time with that here today. Any questions? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. On the pass-through grants that you administer, I guess, do you take a portion of those for administrative costs? And if so, what percentage is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do take a small percentage of administrative costs. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, it's between 1 and 4.5%. So very minimal on the pass-through administrative costs that we keep.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to help us understand, give us the number again that you administer through pass-through grants.
For, Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. So for general fund appropriations, I believe that the amount that we pass through is $4 million.
Representative Nash.
And just in other funds as well, beyond general fund?
Beyond general fund, the legacy appropriation pass-through would be... $2.9 million, and those are again on the backside breakout for pass-throughs, both general fund and legacy.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, and not sure which one can answer this, but in your presentation, I didn't hear anything about the healthy eating program. Just wondering if you could explain for the benefit of the committee what that all entails and what percentage is actually going to the beneficiaries as opposed to the holdback for your administration of that program.
Ms. Beeson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. The healthy eating program was a decision by the legislature, I believe last biennium, to support a grant pass-through program to offer healthy eating options. We could probably follow back up with more information or have somebody from that healthy eating program speak to more detail about that. And I don't know the exact percentage of administrative costs that we use for healthy eating programs, but we can follow back up and get information on that as well. But again, our range is usually between 1 and 4.5%.
And if you could get that information, get it to us so we can get it out to everybody on the committee.
That's exactly the point. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for your presentation, and hopefully we can get that information so we can have the answer to that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next overview up is of the Minnesota Historical Society.
In the interest of time,
yeah,
should we go ahead and get started?
Get started. Yeah, we have the, in your package, there is the copies of the, I'm assuming this is what your presentation is.
Yes, absolutely.
So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, and guests, my name is Kent Whitworth. It's my privilege to serve as the new director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Joining me today is David Kelleher, our Director of Public Policy. I'd also like to recognize our three deputy directors to my left. First off, Dr. Melanie Adams, who oversees our learning initiatives, Jennifer Jones, who heads up our preservation and outreach, and Doug Marty, who oversees our administration at the Minnesota Historical Society. Today we will briefly present an overview on who we are, what we do, how we do it, hopefully have time to touch on a few budget items, and then close with why history matters. That first image, the one point I would make is that this organization was chartered by the territorial legislature 9 years before statehood, and I think that speaks volumes about Minnesotans' interest and commitment to their history. As we think about who the Minnesota Historical Society is, it starts with our mission. We use the power of history to transform lives. We do this by preserving, sharing, and connecting. Clearly, history is powerful and transformative. This bold mission, which has been around for many years, along with MNHS's relentless but not perfect pursuit to fill this mission, is why many people in the country consider this organization the nation's finest state historical society. You may find it a little odd that the director is making a comment like that, but I think I get a pass. I've only been here 6 months. I've been in the field 30 years. So for years, I have been among those who have viewed this organization with real appreciation, and we acknowledge their leadership, and now it's my privilege to serve there. I'd also like to say that history is not simply names and dates. It is a skill. It's really a suite of skills, much like STEM. History is evidence-based, but there's also room for interpretation. But most of all, history is essential. Who we are is defined by our priorities. We have four strategic priorities. The first is to oversee and manage Minnesota's historical resources. You see how we define those resources. The key concept in this first priority is access. Our second priority is educational relevance. We explore not just what happened, but why it happened, and we feel like this helps us as Minnesotans to see the connections between the past and the present. I'd like to acknowledge that there is a natural and really an inevitable tension between the past and the present, but together we can navigate that tension and we think learn from it. Continuing on with who we are, our third priority is inclusion and diversity. Let me tell you a very quick story that was shared by a chaperone. She was accompanying her daughter's field trip to the Minnesota History Center last year and had a group of grade school girls in her charge. As they walked by a banner promoting an upcoming Somali exhibition, which actually opened last June, one of the little girls pointed and she said, "Look, there's my story." That's, I think, what diversity and inclusion look like. Our fourth and final strategic priority is sustainability and stewardship. Years ago, I had a colleague say to me, "We are in the forever business. Those of us in history need to take a long view, especially as it relates to caring for our collections. We also need to make sure we're consistently delivering meaningful visitor experiences. And, of course, we need to make sure that we have the financial resources to fulfill our mission over time." And as I think you know and will reiterate shortly, those are public funds, those are private funds, and those are earned funds. It's a blended financial model that MNHS adopted years ago. So what does the Minnesota Historic Society do to fulfill our mission? We are often known by our exhibitions, and you see the images of 1968. That exhibition closed late Monday afternoon after traveling the country and having two stops in St. Paul at the Minnesota History Center. And just the last weekend, there were 4,000 Minnesotans who came to see that exhibit. But that's just one of many examples. We've got an outstanding research library. If you haven't done research on your community or family, I encourage you to do so. We manage the state archives, and we provide technical assistance and grants to local organizations across the state. And you probably know about the MNHS Press, which is prolific. We hope you have enjoyed any number of those publications. In many cases, what we do is tied to what we have in our collections. Another way to look at it is our collections fuel, they really are the power that fuels much of what we do. When you look at these statistics, you see that the MNHS collection is sizable, but you also need to know that it's very significant, certainly from a state standpoint, but a national and international standpoint as well. Presenting our network of 26 historic sites is core to what we do. I've had the privilege to visit 23 of the 26 so far, from Forest History Center in Grand Rapids to Lower Sioux Agency in Morton. One of the most exciting aspects of working at MNHS and in Minnesota history is that people engage in what we do. These numbers speak for themselves. but I'm pleased to report that this past year we had more than 1.1 million visitors across our museums and historic sites, second consecutive year that we have surpassed 1 million visitors. But you see that we connect with folks in many other ways, almost 5 million visits to our websites. Speaking of numbers, if you're going to look at one page or one slide, I encourage you to focus on this infographic. You probably have a copy of our annual report. If you flip two pages in, you will see that infographic. What this does is capture, it quantifies the impact of the Minnesota Historical Society from July 2017 through June 2018. I hope you'll be pleased to know, and you may already be aware of the fact, that MNHS publishes the Minnesota History textbook used by 80% of Minnesota's sixth graders. Needless to say, this is a core of what we do, and we've got several copies for you to peruse. It's also important to point out that our volunteers and interns are a huge part not only of what we do, but how we do it. And you see those statistics. Let me give you a little more context. This past year, we surpassed a remarkable milestone, and that is 1 million hours of service contributed by volunteers and interns at the Minnesota Historical Society since 1994. Now it's my pleasure to hand off to David Kelleher, who's going to say a little bit more about how we do what we do from a budgetary standpoint. But let me say, on behalf of our governing board, my colleagues on the staff over the years, our 2,600 volunteers and interns, and our more than 24,000 members, we want you to accept our heartfelt thanks to you and the entire state legislature for partnering with us for all these years. We're grateful. David?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm David Kelleher, Director of Public Policy for the Minnesota Historical Society. Thanks for an opportunity to very briefly give you an overview of our budget, and in the interest of time, should any questions come up, we'd be happy to come back. A quick snapshot of the overall budget for the Minnesota Historical Society. Of course, the general fund appropriation provides a solid foundation for all of the work that we do. If you look at our budget in terms of an operating budget, not including capital funds, that makes up roughly a third of our overall budget. And of course, an additional strong component is contributed income from memberships, individual contributions, and earned revenue from stores and other places around our network. And of course, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, Legacy Amendment funds make up a significant part of our budget as well. A good chunk of that, 40 to 50%, goes out to other organizations through grants. How we spend the money, a good chunk of these dollars are staffing. Our staff take care of historic structures around the state in the Historic Sites Network. They welcome visitors at the History Center, in the library and museums. So the staffing and taking care of the buildings that we run for the public make up a significant part of our overall budget. And again, happy to provide some more information at a future date, but that gives you a quick snapshot of our overall budget.
I'd like to close with why history matters. It matters because we are the conduit between the past and the future. MNHS in particular, we've got a great responsibility not only to preserve but to share and provide learning opportunities to share our history and then pass it along to the next generation. And that is embedded in state statute. And then finally, it matters because it's an important component to Minnesota's tourism economy. As I've traveled across the state in my first 6 months on the job, we have asked Minnesotans why their history matters. The responses have been inspiring and very insightful. I particularly love this image and the wisdom of this Minnesota veteran. He wrote, "History is a window to the past and future. Open it." I'm particularly inspired by his call to action. It's always there. History is ubiquitous. But we have the opportunity and really the responsibility to open it. To this veteran's point, history has more to do with the future than it does the past. And I am very encouraged by the future.
especially as I think about the 25,000 Minnesota middle and high school students involved in our National History Day program. Simply put, those students are amazing. This is a photo of the 2018 Minnesota delegation that competed at the National, which is really an International History Day contest, back in June. Suffice it to say that Minnesota had a banner year at National History Day. Four Minnesota projects were selected as national champions. Those projects were produced and presented by students from Minneapolis to Duluth. No state ever has accomplished that feat of four national champion projects in a single year. Minnesota was the first to do it, and it happened last June. Here's one of our national champions with her teacher. In our view at the Minnesota Historical Society, the future is bright because our youth know that history matters. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I was struck as you were talking about this, on the one slide about providing context. It reminded me of my mother when she was mentioned to me one day when she was doing genealogical research into her background and my stepfather's background, and she saw in the census that there were all these 13 and 14 year old boys being sent over here from Germany and Poland in wave with no parents, no guardians, nobody with them. She couldn't understand why. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, that was during the Napoleonic Wars. Uh-huh. And those kids, if their mothers had left them there, they would have been the cannon fodder for the wars that were going on. So they were sending them here to escape that. So, I mean, that's sometimes the context of why things happen. We look at what happened. If we don't know why it happens, it's we can make bad decisions and bad outcomes can come of that. So, Representative Nash, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to Mr. Whitworth or Mr. Kelleher, in page 11 of your annual report is, I think, a piece of good news. The very top talks about the movement of SHPO to a different control agency. I was pleased to sort of spearhead that behind the scenes last year. SHPO used to be sort of a word that people would say and then spit on the ground because it was rather obfuscatory. Can you tell us how that change in control has benefited the people who are working on projects with SHPO as the oversight agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I arrived after that transition, so I think it'd probably be most appropriate to hand off to David.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, SHPO had operated in the Minnesota Historical Society for nearly 50 years, and while it had its challenges, I think a high number of the reviews that they did were on time and were successful. There were a few that ran into bumps on the road. We worked hard to have a smooth transition to the Department of Administration. They're operating under the same federal rules that we did for 50 years, so I think some of the similar challenges will face the Department of Administration. Certainly some of the other challenges with keeping up with technology and making sure that there's good customer service will continue on. We hated to see them go because they were great colleagues, but they're still good colleagues, and we'll continue working with them and supporting them however we can. If your question is, has service gotten better, it's probably too early to tell because they've been in their new home for less than a year, but they're working hard to serve the public.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Whitworth and Mr. Keller. Just a quick question. A couple of years ago when we went through the process of renovating the Capitol, there were a couple of very, very large paintings that were the subject of a vibrant discussion in the governor's reception room. I know that they have been moved now. But question to your board in terms of discernment discussion about what they are going to be replaced with.
Representative Keller, or Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wondered if I might be able to turn to one of our deputy directors, Jennifer Jones, who heads up our preservation and outreach, and it is her team that is working closely with our board on that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representatives. My name is Jennifer Jones. I'm the Director of Preservation and Outreach at the Minnesota Historical Society. So the question about what is going to replace the large paintings that were removed from the governor's reception room. We are in the process of working with our board right now and the CAP board to revise the policy on works of art in the Capitol. We share with the CAP board the responsibility for public and ceremonial spaces, and that is the governor's reception room clearly falls into that area. What our existing policies did not accommodate is really this process for new art. And as everybody understood through the Capital Preservation Commission work and the subcommittee work, that process involves a lot of collaboration with stakeholders across the state. So we are currently in the process and very close to revising our policy. And our policy will specifically lay out the process by which we will begin that collaboration with people to determine the best way to add art to that important room that's really representative of the state, the state's diversity.
Representative Albright, any further questions? Oh, Quan, I didn't see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the the nice production of your report and that book and the content, and I was able to gain good information. I've gained that information. I've placed it there, and if staff, when they collect, can return that so that it could be utilized and conserve resources. Thank you.
Mr. Whitworth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Palm, thank you. We'll be happy to reuse that material with other Minnesotans who might be interested in our work.
Well, thank you for your time today and for the information. And with that, members, if there are no more questions, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.